right. Well, now it's my privilege to introduce our tonight's speaker. Please offer a Warren Valley Group welcome to Alexis from Fresno.
Hi, I'm Alexa. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, man. There's a lot of people here. My sobriety date is December 20th, 2010. My home group is Sierra Fellowship in Clovis, California. And I don't know. That's all I have to say about that. But I'm not feeling grateful at the moment to be here, but I really am grateful to be here and to have an opportunity to be of service. I know Bill H. isn't here, but I would like to thank him for asking me to speak. So I guess I'll kind of like try to jump into it. I was born and raised in Fresno. You know, I started drinking at a pretty young age. I shared at a panel last night, and I told them that I'm Irish and Native American, so I felt like I was kind of an alcoholic, like, out the door, you know? Like, but I don't know. And I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad's an alcoholic. He got sober in these rooms. I think he has a little bit more than a year right now. And he took me to my first AA meeting. I was also one of those kids that, like, was a kid in the meeting, you know, and I'd bring my coloring book and I'd color. And then when I was about 13, like, a member came up to me and he was like, "Oh, so what's your major?" And then my dad stopped taking me to meetings. But, you know, like, I grew up knowing about the fellowship and knowing about the big book and knowing that you got sober through God, basically. And, you know, I saw my dad struggle in these rooms, and he was a retread. I'm a retread. All of his siblings are alcoholics and addicts. His father was an alcoholic. You know, my grandfather died with 20-something years sober. He came to AA for 3 years, worked the steps, and then never came back. So that's how he did it. I hope I don't do it that way. Basically, yeah, I had my first drink when I was 12. I was coconut Malibu rum. It was after a Buchanan football game. I met some older boys. They asked an adult to buy them a bottle, and we, like, walked around and drank this rum. And you know, like, I hear a lot of people in meetings, like, talk about how, like, it was, like, life-changing, like, the first drink they had, and it wasn't that way for me. Like, it was kind of fun. Like, I felt kind of funny. I was able to do things I usually wouldn't be able to do. You know, like, I experienced a little bit of that liquid courage, but, like, it wasn't anything crazy, you know, and... But I did wake up the next morning knowing that I would do it again, you know, and all growing up, like, I thought I was never going to drink, and I never wanted to be like my dad, and, you know, but it just kind of felt good, and it kind of seemed cool, and, you know, and that's just, I just rolled with it, but, I don't know. I mean, I got into a little bit of trouble when I was a kid, but I was a really good kid for the most part. I always struggled in school, but I always tried really hard. I went to the same high school that my mom taught at. We had a graduating class of like 100 kids. And I don't know. I was like super involved. I did FFA. I did AVID. I did leadership. I was homecoming queen. I was president of the traveling literary club. Like, I did it all, and I was usually like a president of it. And like, that was just my gig, and I was already, you know, like, through, like, doing the steps, like, I think I was pretty much a full-blown alcoholic, as well as an addict by the time I was 15, and, I really liked, you know, like, going to high school and, like, playing a part. You know, it talks about that a little bit in the big book, how we're, like, really good at, like, having two faces. And, you know, like, I love showing up, like, at 5 a.m. at the school on a Saturday morning and, like, having my little FFA jacket on and, you know, like, playing that part. And, you know, I really liked, you know, like, receiving that homecoming tiara thing. Like, that was really cool. And, but I knew that I wasn't the person that people thought I was, and, like, everything always felt fake and always felt forced and not genuine, you know, and basically, like, I got to a point in my disease where I just, like, couldn't hold up the facade anymore, and, like, you know, everything started cracking. Let me get back up just a little bit. I'm a middle child. Now I have, like, a whole bunch of siblings, but growing up I had a younger brother and an older brother. My older brother was 4 years older than me. He was a heroin addict. I think he started using heroin when he was about 15 or 16. I'm not super positive, but he died when he was 20 of a heroin overdose, and I was 16. It was around Christmas time. He went to a meeting and, like, scored after the meeting. And, you know, he came home that night and he was obviously high. And he was living with my uncle at the time, who was a former narcotics officer. And he, like, you know, put him to bed and was like, we'll deal with this in the morning. And my uncle stayed up for most of the night watching him. And he fell asleep around 4 a.m. and he woke up around 4:30 a.m. and my brother wasn't breathing. And he immediately started CPR and called the ambulance. And that night I had been at a friend's house drinking and partying and having a good time. And you know, I woke up the next morning to a bunch of missed phone calls, and I called my mom back, and she told me that Jordan had had an overdose and was in the hospital. And I remember talking to her, and, like, my voice went up an octave, and everything was kind of distorted in my vision, and a teacher picked me up and took me to the hospital. And I remember, like, I just had, like, this overwhelming urge to talk about the weather. I just wanted to talk about something normal. And, you know, instead I just didn't say anything. And I got to the hospital, and they had a private waiting room for us, and there was already a social worker there, and I knew that he was probably going to die. And that if he didn't die, that he would never be the same. And, he was in the hospital for a few days in a coma. They're trying to decipher whether or not he was brain dead. They decided he was brain dead on Christmas Eve, and we pulled the plug at 3 p.m. And my youngest brother was 9, and I was 16. And, like, it was weird because growing up with him, like, that was always, like, a fear that, like, I'd come home and find him. And he had been clean, and things had been going good, and, like, he was a little resistant to the program, but he kind of went to meetings, and, you know, just like that, like, my whole life changed, my whole family changed, and, like, that's when I kind of gave up, you know, and I didn't really care about the FFA jacket or, you know, like, the little pins I got from being in leadership. And, you know, and in the next 4 months, like, I noticed that, like, I just couldn't imagine having like a waking moment sober. And you know, like not too long after he died, I started drinking in the morning. I remember the first time I drank in the morning, it was at a friend's house, and we had like partied all night, and I woke up in the morning and I went to the kitchen and I got some beers, and I remember like I hit him because I knew what I was doing wasn't normal. Like it wasn't what my friends were doing, and like I went into the bathroom and drank them. You know, and like I was a daily drinker by the time I was 18. But I went to rehab for the first time when I was 17. I was supposed to go for 90 days. I stayed for 2 weeks. And I came home and like I got a sponsor right away, and I went to meetings and I liked meetings. Like I liked what you people had to say. I noticed that like I'd go to a meeting not feeling super great, and then I'd leave a meeting feeling a little bit better. You know, I got a sponsor and I kind of worked the steps. I was never really honest and I was never really sober, you know, like how I'm sober now. There was always like something, you know, like not drinking in the morning. Like, well, I just won't drink, but like I'll smoke a little bit of weed, or like I'll drink a little bit and I just won't smoke weed or do like all those other things. And, you know, I figured out after a few years that that didn't work. And that, like, if I was going to get this thing, I had to be completely honest. But I went to another rehab program when I was 18 in December. I claimed a sobriety date of December 12, 2009. It sounded pretty cool, like 12-12-09. I liked it. It had a good ring to it. And that's what matters about sobriety dates, is they have a good ring to it, in case you're wondering. I went to this outpatient program. It was an 8-week program. I ended up being there for 6 months. And I was like, it was like the same thing that I did in high school. Like I was like on fire for AA, like, you know, A plus student. Went to double the meetings than I had to go to, and but I wasn't clean or sober. And I never got caught, and I got coined out of that program, and I got really involved in AA and had that same sponsor and got involved in Fresno County Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, like I really liked saying I had more time than I had. It was pretty cool, you know. And what ended up happening is, you know, like the parts started getting harder to play and the facade started getting harder to keep up. And I'd go to meetings and I'd be paranoid. Like anytime anybody shared about like getting honest about sobriety day, I'd be like, they know, you know. Or like one time I was like drinking at this party and I saw some other guy from AA there, and then he was in Ficky Paw, and I was like, oh no, does he know? Was he drinking? And I tried to rack my brains to like, so I'm like, if he was drinking, then it's cool, you know? But I don't know if he was drinking. It was like always on my mind, you know? I remember like right after I got a year, this guy came up to me. He was like, yeah, I had a sobriety date of December 12th once. He was like, but it wasn't true, you know? Like a few weeks after that sobriety date, I smoked some weed at a friend's house, and I thought, oh, it doesn't count. He was like, but I got locked up in sobriety and I had to spend a lot of time alone with God, and I realized that, you know, I had to get honest. And like my mind was blown. I was like, oh no, this guy knows something's going on. And I mean, I don't know if anybody knew or not. I don't know if anybody really cared or not, you know, but I had some really good friends in the program, and what happened is like they observed some like behaviors in me that weren't really normal, and they like called me on it. And and I just had to get honest, you know. Like I knew that I was either gonna like end up drinking again, or I was gonna end up, you know, killing myself. And you know, so I had like, I don't really know how much time I had because I'm not exactly sure on my sobriety date, but I had around 6 months, and I got honest on Founder's Day. And I was supposed to be, I was in this wedding. I was at a wedding, and like I had to go to the rehearsal dinner, and then like right afterwards I had to, went to my sponsor's house, and man, it was so scary. I thought that you guys were going to blacklist me from the program, or at least from like Fresno County AA, I wouldn't be allowed in. That didn't happen. But basically, my sobriety date, my last drunk was not my, where my sobriety date comes from, but my last drunk was pretty horrible, as most of us are, you know, like, they're just horrible. It was summer, and I got really, really drunk at my parents' house when they were on their honeymoon, and I stole a bunch of their liquor, and I had some friends over, and I pulled out a shotgun, and I was in a blackout, and I woke up with that feeling, like, Bill talks about it in his story, like that horror, and like, what did I say, what did I do, like, I know I did something, and I know it wasn't good, and I had to go to work, and I had to be, just been sweating alcohol, you know, and I worked for somebody in the program, I lived with somebody in the program, it was horrible, and like, I can't really remember. I know I'm pretty sure I didn't drink again, but I'm not absolutely positive. But my sobriety date comes from, I kept in case of emergency marijuana in my truck. And it wasn't an emergency, but it, you know, but I had that obsession. And so I, you know, it was in December and I smoked that weed and I felt really, really good. And, like this thought just hit me like a, you know, like a moment of clarity, and I thought, man, this feeling is so good, so wonderful that I'm gonna do anything for it, and I'm gonna like pursue this feeling until it kills me, and it doesn't matter what it was. Like a big part of my story is like I was unable to identify as an alcoholic because of my age and because of you know, my love affair with drugs. You know, I thought I was an addict. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. But, you know, I went home that night after having that moment of clarity, and I went to bed, and the next morning, like, I didn't put anything in my body, and I haven't since. And when I got honest about my sobriety day, like, I kind of just had to, like, go through a calendar and, like, guesstimate. And I picked December 20th, 2010, because it had a good ring to it. And because I knew it gave me, like, at least like a 3-day like buffer, you know, because I didn't want to like have this problem again of being like, well, my shirt's December 20th, like what if it's the 21st, but like I have a few days buffer just in case. That's a horrible feeling of lying. And so yeah, and it was painful to get honest about that sobriety date. Like, it was not easy. And I knew about people where that was part of their story, and like I called them for their experience, strength, and hope. And one guy told me, he was like, man, once I got honest, I felt great. And that was not my experience. Like, once I got honest, I was like, oh man, like I want to drink so bad. And, you know, I think I was like humbled. You know, but I was sitting here, like, during that, like, 1-minute meditation, and I was just, like, thinking to myself, like, just be honest, just be honest, just be real, just be cool, just be honest, you know, it's, like, they'll like you if you're honest, and, like, isn't that great, like, we get to come to this place, and, like, the only thing we really care about, like, the thing that makes us a good speaker is if we're, like, a really honest speaker. And, like, that's the only place where you can really do that. Like, that's the only place I found where I can really do that. Like, I can't go to my work and just be really honest and be considered a good employee. Probably the opposite. I totally lost my train of thought, man. But, yeah, I after that whole thing, like, I just wanted to be as honest as possible, and I just wanted to, like, form like some true, you know, like genuine connections with people in the program. And I think I did like a pretty good job. It was rough. It was a rough summer. You know, I got honest in June. I had about 6 months. I ended up being institutionalized in sobriety. That wasn't fun. And like basically like I think I just wasn't living by spiritual principles and I was still like all crazy, you know, but I was like really not thrilled about like getting 5150 in sobriety. And just in the past month, my youngest brother, who's 14 now, he was 9 when our brother passed away, he just got 5150. And it was so amazing to have had that experience and like be able to like walk him through it. Like I don't think I've ever been more grateful for anything in my life. And you know, like my greatest fear has been losing another brother, and it was scary. It was scary and painful to like sit with my brother in that ER room and like wait to see a social worker, you know. It was scary to have to go and visit him. And some like adolescent psych ward in Ventura, you know. So like I got to do those things, and I got to share like an experience with him that made him a little bit less afraid. And, you know, so, like, whatever, if I got institutionalized in sobriety, you know. But what really changed my recovery is I got a sponsor, a new sponsor, and I love my first sponsor. Like, I just want to, like, make that perfectly clear. I would be dead if it wasn't for her. But I felt like I just needed a new experience with the big book. And I remember, like, having 7 months and, like, sitting in front of my house and, like, crying because I knew that I hadn't worked a first step. Like, I had read Bill's story and, like, all those other chapters, and I introduced myself as an alcoholic, but, like, I knew that I didn't, like, admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I knew because I hadn't done that and was unable to do that, that I would drink again. And it was, like, this weird, like, paradox thinking, but it was scary. It was really scary. And I knew that, like, if I drank again, that I'd probably end up dying. And, you know, I went line by line through that big book with a new person and had a new experience and was able to admit to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic and that there's nothing between me and drink. You know, I came in and out a lot for a few years, I kind of mentioned, and, like, people would talk about, like, just take it one day at a time or, like, just for today, 24 hours. And, like, my messed up head, like, you know, would, like, take those thoughts, and I'd, like, go home from the 5:30 meeting with them, and then I would just wait till midnight to drink, you know? It's like something wasn't working with those, like, phrases in me, and I don't know why, but it just, I couldn't stay sober one day at a time. And, like, doing those first three steps, like, made me realize that I don't have to stay sober one day at a time. Like, I can find this amazing higher power that can keep me sober for forever if I just, like, keep up some, like, agreements with him. You know, my sponsor calls it a contract. And, you know, like, it really, I never thought that it was as simple as, like, I can't, God can, and I'll let him. But it really is, I think, you know. There's, like, my favorite part in the big book is in We Agnostics, and it talks about, like, our basic dilemmas that we're lacking power. We're lacking the necessary power to keep us from that first drink. And like this book is going to outline how to find that power. And like reading that paragraph, I'd read it a million times before, and like when I read it, it just it made sense. And I didn't think that I would ever be able to maintain sobriety that lasted more than a couple of weeks. I thought it was impossible for me. And I guess in a sense it was. But I went through the steps, you know, I did like a super, for me, a super thorough 4-step, and I was able to get really, really honest with my sponsor in doing the 5th step. You know, and I did 6 and 7 and did 8, and then I kind of stopped. And I really didn't think I'd be one of those people to stop. Like, I thought I would keep going. Like, I thought I'd have, like, a lot of momentum. But I stopped, you know, and I had made a few amends with the other sponsors. I wasn't, like, too stressing it. You know, and basically, like, just time has gone by. I had an opportunity to be of service on ACIPOT XLI, All Californian People and Alcoholics Anonymous, the 41st annual ACIPOT Roundup. We held it in Fresno at the Rest and in March, and it was a super amazing experience. And it took up a lot of my time. Like, it was super awesome to be of service and to pull that together, and it was like really spiritual, and like, you know, when it was all said and done, I was like, you know, I'm glad I did that. Like, I'm glad that, like, if there's any like Jordans out there, or there's any Sam's my younger brother, like, that they can, that we had this ACIPOT for them, you know. And if you have the opportunity to be of service at that capacity in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, do it. It's amazing. Any service in AA really is amazing. But so that took up a lot of my time. I had a lopsided triangle. And then, you know, like, that was in March, and all this stuff starts happening with my youngest brother, and, you know, I'm just kind of going along, and I'm thinking, like, it's going to be okay, and, like, I'm okay, and, like, I got this. And what happened for me, you know, like, it was just a couple of weeks ago. I was driving, and I had just gotten off the phone with my sponsor, and, you know how sponsors do. They tell you a bunch of stuff that you don't really want to hear. She told me a bunch of stuff that I didn't want to hear. So I'm driving, and basically she told me that I needed to do more work, which I thought that was ridiculous. But I'm driving, and I just have this feeling like, I can't do any more work. Like, I can't do anything more for God. You know? And like, this whole time, like, my whole sobriety has been based on this idea that God is keeping me safe, that God is keeping me sober, that God is leading me, that God directs my path. And I don't know, like, I was praying, and I told a friend last week that I felt like I had an anti-spiritual experience. Like, I've really critically analyzed this whole process. This is what I've come up with. I had an anti-spiritual experience, just as powerful as all the spiritual experiences I've had, that was proof enough to me that God doesn't exist. And you know, like, I had to call my sponsor and tell her that God isn't real. And like, that sucked, you know. And you know, and then like the first thing she brings up is, she's like, don't you have to speak next week? And I'm like, oh man, I'd totally forgotten about that, because I don't want to think about that. But it's really been hard, you know, the last month. I don't know, I'm just going to be really honest with you guys, because that's what you guys like. But it feels like grief, you know? Like, it feels like I lost something and that I'm never going to get it back, and I hope that I do. I really base everything on my life with the idea that God exists. I'm a theology major. So, you know, that's what I'm dealing with today. And, like, me and my sponsor talked about it, and, you know, like, we talked on Monday, and she was like, you know, it made her feel like a failure as a sponsor, and it put her in fear, and it made me feel like a failure of a member of AA, and of, like, all these other things I identify myself as. And, you know, like, we came to the conclusion that the best thing to do is to, like, start from the start. And, obviously before, like, working the steps, like, brought me to a relationship with a higher power. to a God that was personal to me, and, like, hopefully that will happen again. And, like, what I've come to realize in this, like, existential crisis of mine, which I have one, like, every 6 months, so... what I've come to realize is that I know AA works. You know, like, my faith doesn't waver in AA. And, like, it's unfortunate that my faith wavers in a higher power. That's unfortunate. But my faith doesn't waver in AA. It doesn't waver in the big book. And that big book outlines exactly how this program is supposed to be worked. You know, and... I still believe that, like, that part in Bill's story where Bill, you know, looks across the table at Ebony and he realizes Ebby doesn't have any more willpower or gumption or anything more than what Bill has, yet Ebby's sober and Bill's not. And, like, I still believe that there's nothing in me innately that makes me sober or keeps me sober or gets me sober. So I know AA works, you know, and I just kind of base it on that. And right now, like, I'm just, like, having faith in that action of working the steps, you know, and working with another alcoholic. So, that's all I have to say about that. But, you know, like, sobriety has been really wonderful. It's been really terrible at times. I had, you know, I've had some, like, crazy experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you know, I've gone to 2 funerals of young men that were a part of Ficky Paw, and you know, they basically died as a result of this disease, and that was painful. The last member that we lost, he died of a heroin overdose, and he had 2 brothers and a mom, and it was painful. It was painful to see them experience that pain that, like, I knew so well, you know? You know, but it's unfortunate. Like, I don't think there's any rhyme or reason to it, but, you know, I get to be of service to that family sometimes. The first Mother's Day that passed after he had passed away, like, I went over to the house and I spent a few hours on Mother's Day with them. And, you know, because I knew that Mother's Day is an especially hard day for my mom to experience after losing a son. You know, like, I had this really good friend in sobriety, and, like, he just couldn't get it, and, you know, like, one day I'm at home, like, doing whatever, and his girlfriend calls me, and he's been arrested, and he's in a blackout, and he broke into somebody's apartment, and, you know, and I drove over there and, like, you know, like, call one of my best friends and, like, four-point restraints, like, a guy whose relationship with God, like, I looked up to. And then I had to, like, go to his mom's house and help her clean out his car, and there's all this, like, drugs and alcohol and paraphernalia, and she was heartbroken. And, you know, and today he's sober, and he still has a relationship with God that I look up to, and, you know, that was, like, a really hard day in sobriety. And there's been a lot of times where I've almost drank. You know, like right before I got my 2 years, it was in November. I've been kind of like, just not feeling the program, I guess, you know, just not doing the deal. But, you know, like I was sitting on a couch of a house that I was house sitting, and I thought, man, I really want to drink. And I thought, man, I'm a lot of cigarettes. You know, the logical conclusion that I come to is that I should go buy some liquor and cigarettes, you know, and I went to 3 different liquor stores, and gas stations don't serve hard liquor anymore, I guess, so I had to go to, like, CVS, and, like, I picked out the bottle, and, you know, and it was Jim Beam Red Stacks. I'd seen those commercials in sobriety, and it looked really good, and, like, all, like, walking down the liquor aisle to the checkout stand, like, I was just praying, like, please, God, help me, please, God, help me, please, God, help me, because I was so terrified to drink, but I really wanted to, you know, and I got to the checkout stand, and there wasn't anybody there to check me out, and I waited 15 minutes, and nobody came. You know, so, like, I left, and called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and went over to her house, and read the Big Book with her. And, CVS has horrible service, basically. You know, and, my sponsor was on her honeymoon in Jamaica and had no, like, phones. They have no phones in Jamaica, I guess. But, you know, and the next night, like, I almost drank again. Like, I had that feeling again. It was, like, 4 o'clock in the morning, driving home from a member's house. And still house sitting, and you know, she had some Jim Beam whiskey in her cupboard, and like I poured myself a drink, and I started thinking to myself, you know, if I'm gonna drink, I should probably let my sponsor know. So I started writing her this email, because she can get emails. They have computers, they don't have phones, and. So I write out this email about, like, all this crazy stuff and, like, why I'm about to drink and, like, what my part is in drinking and, like, all this crazy philosophical BS. And then at a certain point I realized I can't send that email to anyone because that would... it was insanity. You know, but, like, I kept on writing, and I just kept on writing, and, you know, like, the last words that I wrote were, like, you know, like, I wrote, like, a series of lines, and some of them said, please, God, let me drink, and please, God, don't let me drink, and I ended up falling asleep, and I didn't drink. And I don't think I stopped myself from drinking, you know, like, you know, and I remember, like, feeling for a few weeks after that that, like, I was disappointed that I didn't drink, that I wouldn't have to be at this meeting if I would have just drank that drink and didn't worry about emailing my sponsor, you know, like, I'm grateful to be sober today, though. I'm glad that, like, that I got into the program. Like, I'm glad that I ended up showing that whole email to my sponsor when she got back into town. No matter how crazy it made me seem, like, I'm grateful that I reached out to people in the program that, like, loved me, you know? And, there's nothing like Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been able to find anything else like Alcoholics Anonymous. So basically, looking for a transition. Exactly. I've got to see a lot of my family recover in these rooms. My dad took me to my first meeting. It was a speaker meeting at 5550 North Fresno Street. It's an all-welcome speaker meeting. It's on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock. The guy speaking was this guy, Al, who lives in Madera. I don't remember anything about what he said except that he hid drugs and money by taping them, like, to the bottom of drawers. That's the only thing I remember. It was my first AA meeting, you know. My dad took me to it, and he tricked me into, like, going to coffee and, like, meeting people who were also young in the program. And he ended up not staying sober. You know, like, he ended up, like, going back out, and I stayed sober. You know, and, like, he called me, and, I was able to tell him, like, dude, you need to go to a meeting, man. You know, like, I hated my dad. And, like, through working the steps, I was able to, like, get that resentment in check enough so that I could love him as another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's sister, my aunt, got sober in these rooms, and she was, like, a super, like, awesome woman in sobriety. You know, I got to turn 21 in sobriety. I didn't think that would ever happen. My plan was, like, to turn 21 and, like, drink. And, like, that was, you know, I was like, I'll do AA until I turn 21, and then it'll be legal, so I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And when I turned 21, I came to the conclusion that's probably still not true, you know? I'll close with this. I didn't think I'd be able to talk for this long. I'm amazed that I did. But it was extremely, extremely painful to turn 21 in sobriety. Not because I didn't get to do, like, the American thing of, like, getting drunk at a kegger. But my brother died, like, just like a month shy of his 21st birthday. And, you know, like, I surpassed my brother in age. And it was painful. It was painful, and it was... it was like a growing pain, you know, but I got to like surpass my brother in age because, like, I've embraced Alcoholics Anonymous. And, like, if you're not, like, embracing Alcoholics Anonymous, like, please do, because it's, like, the best experience that I've ever had of just, like, jumping into the middle of the pack. Of, like, getting in a car and going to a meeting even though I don't want to. Of speaking at a meeting even though I have, like, this newfound atheist thing going on, you know. Of going to, like, six-hour business meetings every Sunday even though they're super lame sometimes, you know. And we provide coffee, so. Thank you guys so much. All right, that's all I have to say.